No one is going to give you a big chunk of money without combing through your business, you know, with a fine-tooth comb across every single aspect.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by Helen McGuire. Helen is an exited founder, author, advisor, mother, podcast host, and DEI changemaker. She's a leading figure in DEI and business strategy, renowned for her impactful initiatives. Helen founded Hopscotch.work, which was the first women's careers platform in the Middle East and Asia. Her journey led to the creation of Diversely.io, which was a groundbreaking AI platform acquired by the Access Group in 2023. Helen's the host of the D&I Jest podcast and author of the upcoming book, The Female Scale. Helen's expertise extends to coaching female founders and advocating for purposeful businesses globally. Helen, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Mark. Thanks for having me. It's been a while since we caught up, hasn't it?
Exactly. So this is Helen's second time on the show. So be sure to listen into our previous interview, which was called Diversity as a Differentiator, How Recruiters Can Attract 70% More Diverse Talent. And by the way, I believe you had a birthday last weekend. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. Yes, I did. I tried not to put it on LinkedIn on my actual birthday because you know what happens when you do that. So I avoided that and just posted it a little bit later. But yes, I did. Thank you very much, Mark.
And actually, your husband, Justin, has been on the podcast twice as well. You guys are like a power couple.
I think your kids are giving you plenty of stuff to talk about.
Absolutely. You've given me four episodes between the two of you. So I think your kids are really fortunate to have those entrepreneurial role models. Like my parents were not. My dad's a doctor and my mom was a nurse, but definitely neither entrepreneurial at all. And I really didn't know anybody. I had a father of a friend of mine when I went to school was an entrepreneur, but that's the only example I can really think of. So that's really, really cool. Let's pick up where we left off. Last time you're on the show was March 2021, just over 3 years ago. It's been a very eventful 3 years for you. You've moved your family, you've scaled and sold your software business. Bring me up to speed on everything that's been happening since we last spoke.
Okay, I'll have to give you the short version of the story, otherwise we'll be here all day, I think. But you summarized it really nicely there. March 2021, we were just about to launch, so we were in beta with Diversely, and I remember speaking to you, being in the midst of handling kind of beta clients, getting the platform together, sorting out all our marketing. We were sort of post-pandemic, pre-move out of Singapore into Dubai, where we'd lived previously for 6-7 years. Been in Singapore for 3 or 4 years and made the move back. Launched Diversely pretty much that summer. It just went from strength to strength in many respects, but there were equally many, many learnings there over that period of time. So Diversely doesn't exist as a brand anymore because, as you said at the beginning, it's now been acquired by the Access Group and is being plugged into software globally through Access Volcanic, which I'm sure some of your listeners will be familiar with, and Access Vincere, and rolled out through the Access Group over time. Between sort of 2021 and I guess March really of this year, it's been about growing Diversely as diversity, equity, and inclusion tech, winning awards for it, building our client base across the UK, the US, and also APAC, working with lots of recruitment businesses directly and agencies, and also in-house with RPOs and bigger firms as well. Building it to the point of exit, which happened last September, which was, you know, a brilliant culmination of a, I guess, 9-year journey in this space for me, building solutions in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space.
Wow. Congratulations, first of all. I mean, that's epic. And wow, what a ride, like from founding to exit in about 3 years?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the journey really started back in 2014, 2015 with my first business. And, you know, you talked at the beginning a little bit about being an entrepreneur. I do come from quite an entrepreneurial background. My dad is an entrepreneur, his family, my husband, obviously, as you just said, and all of his family as well. So I'm kind of surrounded by that. And you do tend to absorb it a little bit by osmosis, but it doesn't prepare you for that world. And it doesn't prepare you for all the lessons that you have to learn yourself and you have to go through, often with the help of other people, of course, to guide you, hopefully to advise you well on these matters. But it is your journey. And that first 4 years of building Hopscotch was a much more kind of in-person service-based solution around the issues of bias in the workplace, specifically focusing on gender. So specifically focusing on women, because that was my experience and my genuine frustration and passion at the time. And, you know, that really enabled me to build the network, the experience, the on-ground understanding of this problem, both in the Middle East and in Asia, to really kind of get to the point where I knew that an in-person business was not going to solve these issues, because the issues of bias in the recruitment process don't just affect women. They affect any underrepresented group. It's the reason that we don't have as much equality and as much diversity as we might like in the working world. And when you start on that mission, it's a very, very difficult one to put down, as anyone who has founded a purpose-driven business will know. And so the solution really off the back of that kind of in-person approach was Diversely, which was tech that solved a similar problem, but did so really at the roots of the issue where recruitment processes and sourcing were concerned, in order to use tech, to use AI, to use algorithms to remove the bias from recruitment processes. So yes, it sounds like when you say, you know, Diversely launched in 2021 and we sold it in 2023, it sounds like a relatively short journey, but actually it was a really long, hard kind of uphill climb to put me and my co-founder in a position where we had the right network, we had the right experience, and we could build and scale that in the way that we did.
Amazing. Yeah, it makes sense. It wasn't from us, like from scratch, that started Diversely and then, you know, scaled to the stars. But there was all of your work for the, I guess, 5 or 6 years prior to that kind of gave you that momentum and that. But still, it's super impressive. I was doing some research before this in preparation for our conversation, Helen. And from what I've been able to gather, so this is for UK. So I don't know the stats in Dubai or you know, Middle East, Asia, and America and other places, but in the population, so it's 50% women in the general population in the UK, but only 18% of UK companies are led by women, so less than 1 in 5. And then in terms of people who identify as being ethnic minorities, there's 18.3% in the general UK population, but only 5 to 8% of small and medium businesses are founded and run by minorities. And so, speaking from your own, obviously you're very educated on this subject, but also as a female founder yourself, what do you think are the additional barriers to founding and running businesses that are faced by female entrepreneurs?
Yeah. I mean, I would like to think about this from an underrepresented category perspective. Mm-hmm. As you said, this is about representation. So that will look very different depending on where you sit in the world. And it will look very different even depending on where you sit within a country or an industry or a vertical. But typically speaking, you know, whether we're talking about women, whether we're talking about race or ethnicity, whether we're talking about LGBTQIA+, whatever those underrepresented groups might be, they are typically underrepresented within workforces. I mean, if you think about when was the last time you heard of even a gay CEO or a transgender CEO, It doesn't really happen. Perhaps even a blind or a deaf leader of a company. I don't know any in the corporate world. I'm not saying they don't exist, but I think that says something. Where I know them is through the podcast, through my podcast, The Digest, where I'm interviewing founders of businesses that are in that position and are then trying to make a difference for other people. So I would say that there are multiple issues here. Accessibility is definitely one. And when we think about accessibility, it's not just in the physical space, it's in the online space as well. So for those with neurodivergent background or in that category, for example, that's a huge challenge for those with disabilities. It's a huge challenge just even understanding and being able to get through a website in order to apply, for example. So inclusion and access are a massive issue. We can then think a little bit about the ways in which the recruitment processes work or don't work for many people. For women, if we're going to think about it from that perspective, then quite often the ways in which job descriptions are written, for example, can be very male-leaning and very off-putting. The ways in which internal culture is put across or is indeed organized within businesses, the ways in which the outreach is done, you know, looking at your classic kind of male networks or school background, university background, those types of things. So there are multiple issues where the ground is essentially not level, the playing field is not fair, and it's set up for certain underrepresented groups in different situations simply to not even get a foot on it, never mind make a success of it. So it's just a different way of trying to look at those processes, to look at things from other people's perspectives and to deploy that within your business through your policies, through your strategies, through your processes and your approaches. There's a lot to think about, but I like to think that if we start at sourcing, if we start at making that process as fair as possible, then we have a much, much better chance of getting those people through the door in the first place.
I mean, that all makes complete sense, Helen. And I guess what I'm coming at it from a entrepreneur founder perspective, and I'm proud that a third of our clients are female founders, which, I mean, obviously we'd like that to be higher, but at least it's more representative. But the challenges that you mentioned in terms of the workplace, how do those translate or carry over if you are starting your own business? And I guess that's what I'm curious about is, like, how can we encourage more women to take that entrepreneurial leap?
Yeah, I mean, this is really what the book is about that I'm writing at the moment. It's not written specifically for women, but it's written with a very female lens. You know, the challenges that you encounter as a woman setting up a business, and there are, you know, so many female-led businesses, startups, smaller businesses out there. But the challenge is then scaling them, because less than 2% of VC money goes to female founders. Myself and my co-founder, both female, also found that was a very tricky situation for us, despite being told by multiple advisors and mentors, all of whom were male, that we had an amazing business case and, you know, we should easily be able to raise X amount, whatever it is. So we went down the road of angel investment, two rounds of that, and we had 18 angel investors globally, which got us to the point that we did and to exit. So I think that's a real challenge where female founders are concerned. I think not kind of seeing it and not having enough female advisors in the world as well. I mean, I actually just did a LinkedIn post on this around the fact that all of my mentors and advisors, when I was building both of my businesses, were male, and absolutely no detriment whatsoever to their advice. I'm super grateful. You know, we wouldn't have got here without much of that advice, for sure. But 99% of them were male. Like, I can think of one female who was amazing. But why? You know, why is that the case? Why is it the case that we don't kind of see people who are two steps ahead of us who are more like us, you know? And whether we're talking about women, whether we're talking about race and ethnicity, disability, you know, different underrepresented groups, it's really, really important that you can see an example of that in your life and your work and around you. So I think there are, you know, there are multiple challenges around getting to that point. And being an entrepreneur is difficult. It's lonely. You know, it can be very, very challenging. And if you don't have the right support and you also have care and responsibilities, as, you know, I do and many other women do, understanding how to balance that is really, really crucial. And again, if you don't have someone who's kind of helping you and just G-ing you along and cheerleading and giving you some strategies and some advice and saying, look, you know, I did it, you can do it, then it is, you know, ever more likely that there is going to be a higher failure rate around that. So yeah, multiple challenges, I think, but yeah, I know so many incredible female founders. I've met so many since I exited my business, just doing things that the world needs, you know, solving problems that the world desperately needs solving. We need these different perspectives, not just women, those with neurodivergent capabilities, etc. We need these different perspectives to solve these problems. So it's more important than ever that these people have an opportunity to take part, you know, to do what everyone else is doing.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, it makes total sense. The first issue you mentioned, I've read that's called the funding gap. Apparently, the average funding achieved by a female founder was £760,000, whereas the average for a male business founder was £4,700,000. So it's like dramatically different. But also, it comes down to what we were talking about at the very beginning of having role models, people who you can aspire, you know, to who are setting that example. And so you're obviously one. I'd like to give a huge shout out to two of my colleagues, Leanne Jones-Hunt and Julie McGrath. So they're both on my coaching team, and they have both been business owners as well, running their own recruiting businesses before they became coaches and advisors and mentors. Helen, I'd love to hear the story of this acquisition, because I know entrepreneurs are always fascinated by, you know, understanding how exits and how that works. Mm. And it's sort of a bit mysterious. Like, I don't know how much you can tell me, but can you talk me through that process in as much detail as you're allowed?
Yeah, for sure. We started being approached by some of our larger partners. Partnerships have always been a huge part of the way that I've done business, that we did business at Diversely. You know, they can open doors more quickly and at better scale than you can on your own, particularly as a small startup. You know, we were never big. We were never more than about 11 people. And they were interested in the tech. And I think for us, we were in a very unique position because we'd built diversity, equity, and inclusion tech that was globally compliant, so therefore could be used by any business anywhere, no matter where they were based or where they were hiring, and that was very unique in the way that it worked and the problem that it solved. We didn't really have any direct competitors, and we knew that our tech was scientifically backed. And was verified and worked. You know, it wasn't a hamster on a wheel in the background, as you see many of these other kind of HR tech solutions. I'm sure you can think of a few. So we were in this position where our partners had interest in either trying to build something similar themselves or figuring out a way that we could get them, they could get the tech into their, you know, different clients and networks and what have you. And I think for us, the end goal had always been to get this tech in as many recruiters' hands as possible, because that's how you solve the problem. Recruiters are at the very front line of so many recruitment processes. And if you can get it into their sort of day-to-day and demonstrate the value, which, by the way, is a 3x improvement on winning new business, it's almost twice as much satisfaction in internal talent, almost twice as much access to skilled talent and relevant talent. So getting these processes right for recruiters had a really tangible payoff. We knew that that is the thing that was going to solve this kind of frustration and problem that we'd set out to solve, or I'd set out to solve 8 years before, and then myself and Hayley had set out to solve a few years before. And so we entertained these conversations, and we probably had sort of three, four, five different bigger partners globally round a table, so to speak, talking to us about an acquisition of the software, because for them to build it themselves, A, would have taken a ridiculously long time. You know, we had specialists, we had experts in this space building it with us, and would have cost them a lot of money as well. And there's no guarantee they would have got it right. So after a bit of verification, an awful lot of conversations, I flew back to London for a period of about 5 days and had kind of face-to-face conversations with a couple of the larger ones. We had a couple of offers on the table, and we went with the Access Group because the Access Group got the problem, and DEI was on their roadmap as a business already to solve, not just for their clients, but also internally. And they wanted the tech as an integration into what was already existing. It wasn't a bolt-on. It wasn't an extra business. It wasn't something else they were going to have to put a load of resource behind to sell. It was an integral part of what they're already doing. And that was the absolute magic ingredient for us, because it's exactly the vision that we had as well. So the two sides of the coin really came together really nicely. Now, was that process a simple one? Absolutely not. For someone who does not come from either a financial or a legal background, it was pretty terrifying, to be perfectly honest. And I think, you know, we were a relatively small business. The Access Group is an acquisitive company, as I'm sure many of your recruitment founders will know and be watching. They've just acquired another business called Elay, which is incredible. That's now integrating into their software as well. But as a small business, it's not a process that they were super familiar with. So we had to kind of build it as we went. It felt a little bit like driving in the dark with my hands tied behind my back half the time. Didn't quite know what was coming down the track on a day-to-day basis. There was obviously a huge amount of scrutiny and detail around everything, not just the tech, but everything that we'd done individually as a business. And that process took about 6 months. And the way that the acquisition worked for us was that they took everything, all of our assets essentially, to take in-house. So that included our platform, it included the podcast for a period of time, it included the tech, obviously, it included part of the team, us for about 6 months. So yeah, everything was kind of brought in-house, and they benefited from everything that we'd created over time, which made complete sense to us as well. I don't want to keep solving the same problem, right? I'm very happy to have got to this point, and now it's kind of integrated and out there. And then, yeah, that deal went through at the end of, very end of August, beginning of September last year. It was announced, and then we kind of went in-house, myself and my co-founder went in-house for a period of about 6 months to kind of relaunch the business in a $9 billion company, which again was like, not an easy process, but the team are absolutely incredible there. I've made some good friends. I've genuinely enjoyed my time, and I'm still consulting with them now. You know, that's kind of out of choice. I didn't have to do that. So, you know, that sort of proves that it wasn't a total nightmare of a process in any way, shape or form, but it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. And, you know, I'm very, very grateful that we got to this point and we have this opportunity. It's exactly what we envisioned. So yeah, anyone who's thinking about going through this process, very happy to have a kind of side conversation on how it all works.
Are you worried about keeping your recruitment firm up to date with the latest technology? After all, your clients expect you to be ahead of the curve. But how do you select the right tech for your recruitment firm and make sure that you earn enough new business as a direct result to make back the cost of your investment? Which is why our friends at iIntro provide in-depth coaching alongside their technology to help you get the most out of your investment. They offer an extensive suite of tools, but let's just take one example, their behavioral assessment tool. It's built right into their online system, so you don't have to buy or learn a whole new platform. They also include training on how to use behavioral assessments to improve your pitching technique while also increasing the longevity of your placements to a staggering 96% after 12 months. For a free demo of iIntro's suite of recruitment tools, including behavioral assessment, just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained. Remember, when you engage with our sponsors, you also help support this podcast. Just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained, then follow the instructions to get started. So it's really interesting, Helen. And so it's 6 months process. Obviously, they're scrutinizing everything, you know, every part of the business. And you hadn't done it before. You described it like driving blindfold with your arms tied behind your back. Yeah. So, like, what was that like from a, because I can imagine, number one, you're still trying to run the business, because what if this acquisition doesn't happen?
Yeah.
You can't put your business on hold and stop, you know, running things while all this due diligence is happening. So that's one challenge. Secondly is, how do you ensure that you're getting the best value and you're not going to be, you know, cheated is the wrong word, but, you know, because you haven't gone through that before, how do you know that you're capturing the most value? And were there any other surprises, challenges, or curveballs during that process?
I mean, I think in terms of there were plenty of curveballs and plenty of surprises. I think one of the biggest around that was the integration side of things, and kind of not having a bit more of an off-ramp where the standalone side of the business was concerned. So, you know, luckily many of those clients were coming to an end of their contracts anyway, or they were already clients of the Access Group. So, you know, it was a relatively smooth transition, but that was something that obviously needed handling. I think it was, you know, it was a stressful situation, because until you get that signature on a, you know, on that document, it's not done. You know, the deal is not done. And there is a long process of negotiations and back and forth, because as we all know in the tech world, for those of you who are in that world, those valuations have dropped quite significantly over the past kind of 18 months, 2 years, you know, particularly in the HR tech space, those multiples have plummeted. So we were in that space where, you know, we knew what the business had been worth, or would have been worth at that point kind of a year ago, but we're perhaps in a completely new space where it was very difficult for anyone to say, because things were just in flux. 2023 was a very, very unpredictable and weird year, not just for the HR recruitment industry, for all industries. You know, when you look at tech, when you look at finance, when you look at banks collapsing, it was kind of, are we going into a major, major global recession here, or aren't we? And I think we narrowly avoided it, but nobody knew. So everyone was kind of hands in pockets, definitely not handing out the cash as readily as they were sort of 2 years before. So it was a very tricky situation. And I think when you're going through that period, this was my second business, right? So I knew what I wanted to achieve from that business. And it wasn't all about the dollar value. I think when you set up a purpose-driven business, it's very important to keep profit and profitability in mind, because it's hard to create impact without that. It's not sustainable as a business, as an idea. But equally, you've got to balance it with, you know, what am I doing here to solve this problem, and how can I solve this problem? And we would have taken another God knows how many years to try and get to the scale that Diversely, even though it's not really a brand anymore, is now. You know, it's now in the hands of, I don't know, 20,000 recruiters maybe globally. I don't know, probably even more than that. And that's nuts. And you have to kind of, so when you're thinking about selling your business, it's not just about what do I need from it as a dollar value. It's what can I also achieve off the back of that? What does that give me as a founder, as someone who's going on this journey? You know, there are many, many other benefits of being in that lucky position. And there aren't many people who get to that point. I mean, from a female founder perspective, I think it's something like 0.5% of female founders manage to have a, you know, tech business acquired. From a male founder perspective, I don't know, but it's, you know, we all know the stats, right? On the startup front, it's not great. So I think you have to look at it on balance and go through those periods and just keep putting one foot in front of the other, and eyes on the prize.
Absolutely. So knowing what you know now, is there anything that you would have done differently or, you know, during that acquisition?
Yeah, there is actually. There are a couple of things that have kind of come up since then that I think I would have done differently. A couple I probably can't really talk about, but one of them I think is just being a bit more prepared for the level of due diligence that you will have to go through. No one is going to give you a big chunk of money without combing through your business, you know, with a fine tooth comb across every single aspect. So just being a bit more ready around that, you know, as a small kind of startup, we were relatively well organized, but not organized to this level. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot that, you know, we needed to go back over and just put in a place that other people would find it easy to look at, for example, and think about spreadsheets and all of these types of things that you need to have in place and different agreements and so on. So just trying to get those things in order so that you can put them into what they call a data room, which is essentially what the business will set up for you that's acquiring you. And there will be multiple folders in there that you need to put all your stuff into. And yeah, if you have a bit more of a, if you understand what that looks like and you organize your business around that, ready for sale, it's so much quicker and easier then to represent yourself. So yeah, that's one thing, just kind of being a bit more aware of what that process actually involves.
That's really interesting. I've never heard of this data room before, so that's useful.
Yeah, I mean, we've been through it a couple of times with investors. So when we were going for investment or speaking to investors, but it was sort of 10 times the size, you know, the different agreements and things that we needed to pass across for them to look at and all the rest of it. So yeah, there was a lot of that. And I would also say we didn't have an accountant. We didn't employ an accountant. We didn't employ a lawyer as standard as part of our business. We did that in-house as much as possible. That was a really, really important investment for us to get this across the line. There are just, you know, as a founder, there will be gaps in your knowledge. Most founders do not come from an accountancy or a legal background, particularly in the recruitment space. So having somebody that can just do these things easily and quickly and also give you their expertise on what the right way is and what the wrong way is and what to expect and everything else was just an absolute lifesaver. They were incredible people. So again, if anyone needs any advice on that front, we found a couple of fractional people that we brought in who were brilliant. So yeah, you know, getting the right advice in place, getting those structures in place it makes it all just a lot smoother and a lot easier. And now I know where to go and what to expect. But before you start that process, it's just a black box, right?
Wow. That sounds like stressful, but also kind of exciting at the same time. It must have just been a wow. Plus, like all the normal life has to happen, right? You're a mom and you've got kids and you've
100%. We had our 10th wedding anniversary last August. So this had been planned for about a year. And obviously I didn't know that we were going to be selling our business at that point. And so we had 40, 45 people flying in from all over the world to celebrate in Paris. And at the same time, I was doing this deal, the background and just, yeah, trying to set up an office wherever we were to try and make sure that I was there to go through, to jump on calls with our legal people or their legal people, you know, whatever it was, just making it happen. It was stressful for sure, but equally, again, as I said, you keep putting one foot in front of the other. You listen to what they need. You try and translate it from what you have. You keep your eyes on where you're trying to go and what the end goal is, and you know you get there in the end. And it is a very strange feeling when you're sitting in a co-working space on a Friday afternoon, and suddenly all the completed documents come through, and all you need to do is put a digital signature on a few of them and you're done. And that's
it. Wow. That must have been sort of surreal.
Very surreal. It was very surreal. Yeah. I didn't quite know, you know, I'm in a co-working, right? I'm on my own. So no one else knows what I've just done. And I felt like kind of standing up and telling everybody, but I resisted and went home and told everyone instead.
You feel like at that moment, like if it was a movie, right, there'd be some, like there'd be a soundtrack and there'd be like champagne. And not just sitting by yourself in a co-working space, digitally signing something. And
it was a weird, weird moment, particularly, as I said, because of, you know, everything that you not just the acquisition process, but everything that you go through to get to that moment. All of the good bits, all of the bad bits, whatever. It's pretty surreal. So and then it all happened very quickly off the back of that. You know, we were straight, there was no break. We were straight into getting this stuff integrated, getting it out there, and launching it as part of Access Volcanic, all of the marketing, the survey that we did, the report that we did around diversity, equity, and inclusion, which I'll send to you. Actually, you can share it with your with your listeners, because that is the absolute blueprint of this is why it's a good business case. This is why a company like the Access Group acquired a company like Diversely, because the numbers are just insane, you know, once you start deploying these types of approaches in your business. All of that stuff kind of then kicks off, and off we went on another little adventure.
And so the next chapter then, tell me about your book, The Female Scale.
Yeah. So I started writing this pretty quickly after the acquisition, because I didn't want to forget, to be perfectly honest. I didn't want to forget kind of everything that I'd learned and been through. I wanted to put it down on paper for myself. I wanted to put it down on paper for my kids, actually. You know, they're still young. My eldest is 9. My youngest is 5. They're not really going to have any memory of this or understand really what it's about when they're older. But more than that, I wanted to help other founders, particularly underrepresented founders, go on this journey as well, because I learned a lot, have learned a lot, but also made a lot of mistakes, didn't see a lot of things coming down the track, this acquisition being one of them, you know, as we've just kind of been through. But you know, had 3 kids in the process and moved countries 3 times or whatever it was. So I think it is about really helping those that have a vision, that have a passion, that want to turn that into purpose, helping them move down that road to make it into a profitable business that has impact, and understanding that you might start off with a kind of warm, fuzzy idea of what you want to solve in the world, but you've got to be very business savvy about it. And you cannot lose that line between passion and purpose and profit, because otherwise the impact you want to create is going to be lost. So it's really taking people through that roadmap and that journey, sharing some of my stories, lots of practical examples and theory around it as well, so that other people can hopefully, you know, make an impact in the world in the way that I've tried to do.
I love it. I am looking forward to reading it. When can I get my hands on it?
Well, should be September, October now. So we are nearly finished. It's going to go off to the editors. I'm not saying we. It's literally just been me writing it for the last 7 months. Royal we. It's going off to the editors. Hopefully, my aim is end of next week. So we're very, very close to getting it done. And I've worked with 2 brilliant book coaches in the UK who have, you know, really sort of helped me to understand what a good book looks like. It will be over to them to do the editing process. And then, it will be launched in September, October of this year.
Amazing. I would love to pick your brains, actually, Helen, because I want to write a book. So I'm putting that out there on the podcast.
Okay.
Public accountability. It's been on my sort of bucket list for a long time. I need to actually get it done. And so I'd love to learn from your experience. But
yeah, 100%.
Super, super exciting. I'm, you know, congratulations on selling the business, getting this tech in the hands of 20,000 plus recruiters around the world and having an impact on such a massive scale. That's phenomenal. Really, really incredible achievement.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was a proud, it has been a very sort of surreal, but you know, it was a very proud moment. to get to that point in the journey. I know lots of other people don't quite make it, so I'm hopeful I can inspire some future founders to make an impact too.
Thank you for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. I know how busy recruiters are, so I'm honored that you're investing this time with me each week. I don't take your attention for granted. That's why I'm going all out to deliver value for you here, real insights you can apply to improve your business. And if you really want to help me to reach a wider audience and impact more people, please consider leaving the show a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave me a review, please reach out and let me know so I can thank you personally. Please hit the subscribe button and I'll see you next time.